Welcome to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase, our monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. November is a time for reflecting on our many cultural blessings across the state. This month, we'll join Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner as he explores behind the scenes at the Cedar Valley House Concerts. We'll peek at several exhibits in and around Davenport's Figge Art Museum. We'll hear about the Ames-based modern dance company called Co-Motion Dance Theater. We'll investigate the Des Moines Metro Opera's second stage's collaborations with Stage West Theater. And we'll follow two citizens of the world with Iowa connections, Dan and Kathy Eldon, as we take this bittersweet journey along with his son and his amazing mother. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
I'm excited to be able to share that I finally, after 16 years, wrote a memoir. It's called In the Heart of Life, and it tells my story across many continents. And it's a love story, it's a metaphysical mystery, it's an adventure, it's an African saga, and I'd love for people to read it. You don't have to buy it, download it, go to the library, but I'd be honored to have people read it. And it starts in Iowa, and it's those Iowa values that sometimes I failed, but I've come back to.
Kathy Eldon, founder and chair of the Creative Visions Foundation, and journalist, author, film, and TV producer in England, Africa, and the U.S. Kathy grew up in Cedar Rapids, joined the Peace Corps, and was sent to teach art at Taft Middle School in CR. She ended up marrying a Brit, and after a short stint in England, they moved with their two children, Dan and Amy, to Kenya. Every summer, the kids return to Iowa to visit their grandparents, Russell and Louise Knapp, and enjoy a retreat at the Wise Camp Wapsie. While in Kenya, Kathy became a journalist for the Nation newspaper.
Dan took pictures for me and trailed along behind me, starting at the age of 8 or 9. When he was 21, he was back and forth between Coe College, Richmond University in England, and UCLA, and he was going to go to UCLA to film school. And a friend of his, who was a young journalist, told him that there was a rumor of a terrible famine in Somalia, which is just like going to Minnesota, and suggested that Dan might wish to go with his camera and see what was going on there. And Aidan Hartley and Dan flew into Somalia and discovered that there was indeed a horrific famine. Dan's photographs became among the very first to alert the world to this famine and really help trigger a global response. Journalists from around the world flowed in. Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Diane Sawyer, incredible journalists. But Dan was there first, which was really exciting for him. He stayed that year as it became increasingly tempestuous. It went from a famine and into a civil war to the point where many, many people were dying. He called me on my birthday. It was the 26th of June, 1993. He was 22 years old and told me that he was going to go back in, although we thought he was leaving. And I said, Dan, don't you think it's time that you left? And he said, Mom, don't ask me to leave. The job isn't done. I said, okay. Really long pause. Okay. You're living the life of your choice, and I'm so proud of you. And at that point, he said, Mom, I'm sending you a ticket to Nairobi. I love you so much. And I said, no, I'm sending you a ticket to London. And we said goodbye. And that was the last time I spoke to him. 2 weeks later, there was a terrible bombing by UN forces of a house where this warlord was hiding, rather like Osama bin Laden. And the intention was to try to kill the warlord. Unfortunately, it was a peace meeting. And more than 50 people were killed and another 200 wounded. After that happened, the survivors ran to the journalist hotel and begged the journalist to come and record the carnage. Dan and some other colleagues jumped into vehicles under protection. But when they arrived at the site of the carnage, really it was a villa which had been blown up, the people were so enraged by what had happened that they beat and stoned the journalist to death. So 4 were killed, including Dan.
Now, Dan, he was not your average bear guy. He was into all sorts of things, and he had a real mission about helping, as far as he bought jewelry and all sorts of things and sold things to help people.
I think Dan was inspired by the attitude in Kenya. Quite frankly, if something wasn't happening, you had to go and do it yourself. So there were very few social services. And when a lovely friend of his, a 13, 14-year-old girl, became very ill with a heart condition, it was quite natural for him to decide to try to help. She was a scholarship student. She would have died if they hadn't helped. So he started something called Operation Save a Heart and threw wild parties in our backyard to raise the money for this young girl. They raised $5,000, which was a lot of money in those days, and she had the heart operation. So it was natural, maybe, when he knew a family and his Maasai mama, Kip and Get, but her husband was a bit of a loser. She had 7 children and couldn't make the school fees. So Dan asked her to make more jewelry, and she made masses of jewelry. Dan went out, sold this jewelry, and brought the money back. When he was 19 years old, he took on a community. And the community was a refugee camp in Malawi that he had visited the year before. He gathered 15 friends together and said, right, we're going to take aid to this refugee camp. You want to come along? And included on that trip was Christopher Nolan, who's now the director of Batman, Jeff Gettleman, who is the bureau chief for the New York Times, Ellie Tatum, who is the publisher of the Amsterdam News, and my daughter Amy, who was 15 at the time. They went across 4 countries. It took several weeks. These teenagers, everybody says, why did you let them go? But it never occurred to us not to, because kids are capable of tremendous things if you let them. And it wasn't that dangerous. It was pretty dangerous, but they made it. And they really transformed the lives of this camp because they gave them money for 2 wells. So I was very proud of him. And then actually, he took on a country. So he went from an individual to a family, to a community, to a country of Somalia, which he tried very hard to help.
And in Somalia, he was unique in the fact that he went from all sorts of people and was known to transverse from the heads of state down to people on the streets and to be able to talk to these people.
Dan got along with everybody. He was known by his Maasai mother as Lesharo, which means the laughing one. He had grown up in a very multicultural society. His high school had 46 nationalities, his school, the International School of Kenya. So he felt very comfortable with just about anybody. I think it may have made him overly confident in one way, because he could defuse any situation. However, at the very end, when he was running from the mob, he knew himself that you cannot reason with an angry mob. That is absolutely impossible. It has no mind, no intelligence.
Now, after his tragic death, you personally wanted to do something and get involved, and you really have done some amazing things. Tell us about that.
For me, I believe I would have died, imploded, if I couldn't transform the grief that I felt at the passing of Dan and his friends, and actually, to be honest, all those Somalis who died as well. It was too horrible to think that that was the end. So at the memorial service, I approached the head of Reuters, Mark Wood, and I said, Mark, we have to transform this into something positive. And he said, I'll give you all the help I can give you. So together with AP, Associated Press, and Reuters, we created an exhibit of the work of the journalists who'd been killed called Images of Conflict. And that exhibit is on show right now at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art, where I think it's going to be a bit longer. And that show has traveled to 6 countries. It's been opened by 6 heads of state, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw. And that was the very beginning of this intention to do something positive. We created a film together with Turner Broadcasting called Dying to Tell the Story, which is available online, about journalists at risk. And right now, all over the world, journalists are in peril. In the old days, they were caught up by accident. Now they are stalked, harassed, tortured, murdered, executed, imprisoned. It is a terrifying thing in many instances to be a journalist, whether it's in Somalia or in Syria or in Palestine right now. I can't imagine what it's like. We moved on to do a book about grieving, which is called Angel Catcher, A Journal of Loss and Remembrance, which was Amy, my daughter, and I, then 20, 21, trying to capture how you can move from the pain of loss into something that is, again, about acceptance and peace. And that is a long journey. And sometimes it's a lifetime journey, but it's a journey that's worth making because we don't want to stay in the sadness. We really need to be able to move out of the sadness. We later launched a foundation called Creative Visions Foundation, celebrating creative activists, creative, active people who are seeking solutions to challenges in the world around them. We work with journalists, writers, art, music, dance, drama, film. It's all about storytelling. It's all about public radio. It's all about telling stories that need to be told about problems that need to be solved, and then encouraging people to go and act as a result of it.
So you took art and used it as a form of healing.
Absolutely. We can choose that which gives us the most joy and use it for our healing. I believe that to be able to activate our souls, to be able to take the essence of who we are and then share it with others, it's to achieve your potential both for yourself and others, is the essence of happiness, and to find community within that. We now have more than 200 projects and productions that we've nurtured and incubated through the Creative Visions Foundation. We have 84 projects right now in the world, including the film Happy by Rocco Belic, who is on Safari with Dan. That film, Happy, is looking at what makes us happy. And it's not necessarily the next Mercedes. It's really about how we can impact one another's lives in a positive way.
Tell us about the exhibits you have with Dan's journals.
Dan, after his death, we discovered 20 journals. I knew he'd done a couple, and I was an art teacher, and I thought they were very nice. But I had no idea of the depth, width, breadth of these journals. They're like archaeological digs, bulging with snakeskins and drawings and photographs and you name it. They are right now the basis of 3 books. The Journey is the Destination has sold over 100,000 copies, and it's a collection of Dan's journal pages. Dan Eldon, The Art of Life, written by Jennifer New, who is an Iowa City very talented writer, is an illustrated biography. And more recently, Safari as a Way of Life is this bubbling fun. You pull out postcards and posters and all kinds of, it's an interactive book for kids. Safari as a Way of Life.
So what would you like people to know about your crusade now?
I think that Dan is a spark. And I think often we don't realize that we're sparks for other people. He certainly didn't know he was going to be a spark that actually millions of people will have heard about and been catalyzed by. And I would encourage people to find your spark. Find that which gives you a sense of lightness and brightness in a world which is really quite troubled. And coming to Iowa, it feels like a peaceful haven. But we need to all activate our souls. We really need to be alive to what's happening in the world and our role in the world of one of transformation.
Teacher, journalist, author, film and television producer Kathy Eldon. To learn more about Creative Visions Foundation, go to creativevisions.org. And to get more background on the founder, go to kathyeldon.com. For more information about artist, adventurer, and activist Dan Eldon, who was killed in 1993 while on assignment for Reuters News Agency in Somalia, go to daneldon.org. Dan Eldon's exhibit will be on display at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art through the end of December. You can find out more details by going to crma.org and viewing The Restless Spirit under the museum's current exhibit heading. The War and Peace Project will continue through December 7th at the Burling Library Art Gallery on the Grinnell College campus. The Des Moines Art Center's exhibition From Icon to Abstraction continues now until February 15th. The Hearst Center for the Arts in Cedar Falls will be showing the film The Fighting Sullivans on November 11th. Also at the Hearst through the end of the month, you'll be able to see the original book illustrations by Gary Kelly for The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. The story of Iowa's chalk talker Herb Hake continues at LaPorte City's FFA Historical and Ag Museum through November 22nd. And continuing now through Thursday, November 13th, the 12th Annual Wild Rose Independent Film Festival is being held at the Fleur Cinema in Des Moines. Just ahead, we'll see what exhibits Davenport's Figge Art Museum has on display, We'll speak with a woman who has dedicated her life to dance. We'll discover how the Des Moines Metro Opera and the Stage West Theater have joined forces. And we'll follow Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner as he investigates the entertaining house concert concept. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
We have a max capacity of about 42. That's comfortably sitting. A little more than that, you end up standing. It's a pretty open space, so we move all the furniture out of the house. We put flyers up around town and invite whoever is a music fan to come to the show. All of the proceeds go to the artists. We're 100% nonprofit. We urge people who are coming to the shows to bring a side dish. We put everything out. People share. Bring your beverage of choice. We do enforce alcohol with 21 and over, but all of our shows are all ages.
It is kind of like you don't really know what you're walking into because you're like, wait, so I'm going to like a stranger's house? Like, I don't know these people, and I'm just supposed to walk up to their front door and be like, hi, I'm here for the concert. But that's exactly how it works. But see, you just got to remember that anybody like Doris and Cedar Valley House concerts, anybody hosting these loves music. They love music and they just want to support the arts and artists. So, well, at the beginning, if it's your first time at a house concert, you could be like, oh, this is weird. I feel awkward. Like, you're 5 feet in front of me on a couch. What? You're just going to sing there? After a couple songs and like everybody gets comfortable with each other, and it's up to the artist to make everybody feel comfortable, that's, I think, when the magic starts happening.
That's Cedar Falls resident Doris Manjan and singer-songwriter Danica Holmes talking about Cedar Valley House Concerts. Since 2008, Doris has been hosting performances by traveling musicians in her own living room, with an average of one or two shows per month in the fall, winter, and spring. She describes it as a private party where we invite all music fans. The idea came about from Doris's own love of music.
I've always been an avid music fan. I'm originally from Phoenix and grew up going to concerts constantly. Moved here and didn't see quite the large capacity of musicians coming through. Was making trips to Chicago, Minnesota, Kansas City to go see who I wanted to hear. And in 2008, we bought this huge house and I wanted to open up a cafe wine bar. That didn't work out. Elliot Morris was passing through doing a house tour and asked if he could play. And I said, there we go. That works. We have a 100-year-old Dutch colonial and we didn't have furniture to fill it and realized the acoustics in the living room were amazing. So that's what made us decide to do the house. A lot of musicians in 2007, 2008 were being dropped from labels and doing smaller tours, weren't booking the larger bars. So they were looking for homes that were willing to let them play there acoustically.
And do I understand correctly that the artists sometimes spend the night at your house?
They do. Because they're usually on the road between Chicago and Denver or Minneapolis, heading down to Kansas City, we offer them a little break in the larger tours. They stay at the house. We provide dinner. If they need to do laundry, they have that as well. And sometimes they get breakfast.
What sort of reaction do you get from the artists coming through and from your audience members?
From the artists coming through, they're just thrilled that they have somewhere to play like this. They say it puts them in touch with their fans on a more intimate basis. From the fans who come to see them, they're just amazed that they're seeing somebody play in a house.
Is the only way you get the word about this to the fans through social media? I know you're on Facebook.
Yep, we also have a website. Most of it is through social media or directly through the artist's website on their tour pages. A lot of the music I tend to follow, so I kind of see where they're going, get in touch. Now more so, they contact me. There's been enough word of mouth, I think, so they get in touch when they're passing through the Midwest.
Doris's word-of-mouth approach was successful in reaching Iowa native Danica Holmes. Danica currently resides in Nashville, but frequently performs in Iowa and has appeared on the Iowa Public Radio show Java Blend. Danica performed at Cedar Valley House Concerts in October with her musical partner, guitarist and songwriter Jeb Hart. Getting the concert set up took almost no time at all.
I just did a tweet. I love Twitter. And it was just about how I really like playing house concerts. And one of my friends tweeted me back and just said, check out Cedar Valley House Concerts. So I immediately did, and I emailed Doris. And then within 5 minutes or 10 minutes of me even sending the tweet out, we had this concert on the calendar. So that's how I ended up in this living room tonight.
Is this a unique thing? Do you know of anybody else who does this sort of thing?
I actually know quite a few artists in Nashville who do. It's really popular for singer-songwriters, like people who are verbal and they like to kind of introduce their songs with stories. And it's common for soloists, not so much for bands. So yeah, I actually do know quite a few people who do house concerts.
For Danica, the experience of playing in a living room provides an interesting contrast with her other performance situations.
A lot of artists find themselves in really diverse performance situations. For example, here we are on a Tuesday night in Cedar Falls, Iowa, about to play a house concert for, you know, what could be 15 to 50 people. You just never really know who's going to show up. You're in a living room, you're super close, you're on stools. We're not even using a sound system tonight. That's how intimate this is. And then Saturday night, we played in a gigantic performing arts center with the state-of-the-art sound system and lights and a grand piano and set design. And, you know, we had our drummer there. They're two completely different types of concerts, but I love doing them both. And I think there's a place for both of them. We have people come to the big shows and they're like, that was amazing. And then they'll come to a house concert and be like, we love that too. It's just, they're different scenarios. So I guess what I'm saying is a lot of artists now, you could go on tour, you're playing festivals, you're doing house concerts, you're doing performing arts centers, your city concert series. There is no one sort of scenario you're walking into. Every night's always a little bit different.
Danica has some encouraging words for anyone interested in the idea of a house concert.
If you haven't been to a house concert, I would highly recommend checking them out. You can host them. There's a couple ways to host house concerts. Sometimes hosts like to just pay the artist a flat fee and then just invite as many people as they can. That's one way. And then another way is to do a ticket or a suggested donation at the door, and that goes to the artist. Either one works. They're both great. It just sort of depends on, as a host, what you're looking for. So if house concerts are new to you, I would just go to one first. Check it out. Go to one. Meet the artist. Talk to the host. You might find out that you would maybe want to host one yourself. And if you do, you can call me or email me. We'd love to come do it.
Cedar Valley House Concerts can be found on the web at cvhouseconcerts.wix.com/CVHC. There, you'll find a schedule of upcoming performances, a photo gallery, and contact information. You can also find Cedar Valley House Concerts on Facebook. For Iowa Public Radio, I'm Tony Daner.
The Cedar Valley Chamber Music will start their new house concert series this month with a Waterloo concert on November 15th, featuring the internationally acclaimed trio 826. For more details, please see facebook.com/CVCMF. Just ahead, we'll mark our dance card with Co-Motion Dance Theater. We'll explore what the collaborating Des Moines Metro Opera and Stage West Theater are presenting, and we'll tour the Figge Art Museum with their executive director, Tim Schiffer. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
The last Thursday of every month, we have Pachakacha Night, which is a kind of presentation where speakers talk about a topic of their choice, artwork, travels, you name it, and they have 20 seconds to talk about 20 slides, 20 seconds per slide. So they speak for about 6.5 minutes. And we usually have 8 to 10 speakers per night, and it is really fun. It's a great way to see what creative people are doing out and about. And we're always looking for people to present, too. So it's a fun, interactive thing that we do.
Tim Schiffer, the Figge Museum's executive director. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. The Figge originally opened in 1925 as the Davenport Municipal Art Gallery. It was the first municipal art gallery in Iowa. The museum got its start thanks to the foresight of one of Davenport's most generous and civic-minded citizens.
It started when Mayor Ficca gave 350 artworks to the city on the condition that they create an art gallery. So we were a city museum up until the Figge was built and opened in 2005. And now we're a nonprofit, but we are the custodians of the city's collection.
Next year, you're going to be celebrating a big anniversary. And this new building, how does this all fit into this?
We're celebrating the 10th anniversary in our building and also the 90th anniversary of the founding of the museum. So we're celebrating that we've grown to this point, and we're hoping to bring the architect here from London, David Chipperfield. And we're publishing a book about the history of the museum and the collection and the building and just generally celebrating.
And originally you said you had like 350 different works of art, but that has grown tremendously.
Now we're at about 4,000 works of art and always growing. We have people offer us works all the time, which is great, and we purchase works. We're growing the collection so that we can keep reinventing ourselves, I guess.
And the Figge is known also for collaborating with different organizations in the community.
We have tons of collaborations. We have a community gallery that we show the work of students from all the local school districts. We have a college invitational for students from the local colleges. This fall, we're doing a show of faculty from all the local colleges. Plus, we are partners with the University of Iowa Museum of Art, which was flooded in 2008. So we house their collection here, and we do a lot of programming with them for that.
And right now, you have a special exhibit that's called A Legacy for Iowa.
The Legacy for Iowa exhibit is the masterworks from the University of Iowa collection. Not the Jackson Pollock, which is in Sioux City right now, but really modernist masterpieces that they collected over the course of their life. So we're very lucky to have them here.
Now, you have this African-American art since 1950, and that's going to continue until January. Tell us a little bit about that exhibit.
Well, we bring in exhibits from all over the country, and this is coming from the Driscoll Center at the University of Maryland, which is a center for the study of African-American art. So it's really looking at African-American art since 1950 as a distinct genre of art and kind of the key artists that have participated during that time. And then in November, we're bringing in a second show that will kind of bookcase the Driscoll show, which is called Self-Taught Genius. And it is from the American Folk Art Museum in New York. And it is really the idea of the self-taught artist, which overlaps a lot with a lot of African-American artists. And that idea of the self-taught artist as typical of the American personality as a country.
I haven't seen this African-American exhibit, but I know I saw some pictures from the folk art, and they're unusual things like a gate. It's not a painting, it's a gate, and different types of things that you might not, on first glance, think of as art.
Well, folk art takes in everything from, you know, sewing to cigar boxes, the works. And so there's a little bit of everything in the show. And the idea of it is that in the United States, since before the Revolution, there's this mindset that anyone can do anything and anyone can grow up to be president. And so also anyone can be an artist. And instead of having the academies and like the aristocracy that you had in Europe that fostered the arts, in the United States, you could be a sign painter and really be an artist in your own right. And this show is really about that concept and how that has changed over the years. And in contemporary art, the self-taught or the outsider is really valued as someone who is maybe more in touch with their personality or more whose work is more raw or more sincere, I guess, than someone who's been trained in art. So it's a really interesting dialogue over about 200 years about art.
And with this African-American exhibit, this is also more of sort of this progression of art?
I think it's an idea about African-American artists going beyond either being folk artists or being artists who are imitating like modernism or other kind of trends in modern art and really looking more at African-American identity as a springboard for their own art. And if you look at our culture as a whole of, you know, African-American culture becoming a very important and influential aspect of the larger culture, art also reflects that, and art actually kind of leads that. So there's a lot of kind of postmodern conceptual ideas about personal identity versus societal identity that are reflected in the art. And the interesting thing is that in the folk art show, there are several artworks that we know were done by slaves. And so there are also some more recent African-American folk artists who are quite celebrated. So there's a real kind of a continuum of kind of a mini dialogue through those two shows that should be really interesting.
So what sort of things are in this African-American exhibit?
It goes all the way up to the present. There are some of the key artists who really came to be known as African-American artists as opposed to just artists, like Betty Saar, I think, who's really very celebrated. Some of the newer artists, Micheline Thomas, for instance, who are really creating a new kind of art that really specifically relates to African-American culture.
Tell us about your Turn Wood exhibit, and you're going to be actually constructing something.
We have an artist coming from Ireland who is building a lathe on our plaza outdoor. It's going to be made out of concrete, and it's about 5 feet on either side, and he is going to use this lathe to turn a giant wood sculpture out of a whole tree trunk. So it'll be about 3 feet in diameter, and it will turn on this lathe, and he's going to carve with a chainsaw and create a wooden throne sculpture that's going to be actually installed at the River Center in Davenport when it's finished. So it's a great project. And then we're showing, at the same time, we have a collection of turned wood and kind of wood sculptures that we're showing in our gallery inside. But those are the little ones, and he's doing the giant one.
A lot of times guys think, oh, I don't want to go to a museum. But when you get wood involved, I could see them showing up.
Exactly. And that's, I think, you know, as an art museum, we are always trying to find shows and find artists that make people reassess their resistance to art. So this is one way to do that. And we think it will be very participatory because the artists will be here and you can see the artwork progress, you know, over the course of a couple of weeks. And then the final piece will be around forever. So it's great. And we're really looking at ways to use our plaza and kind of make it part of the street life and give people a fun way to interact with artists and to bring out their inner artist, I guess you'd say.
How can folks get more information about the Figge and the classes and all the extra things that you have going on here?
The best way is to go to our website, figgeartmuseum.org, F-I-G-G-E, and you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter and see all the classes. We have stuff going on all the time. Every Thursday night, we are open for free from 5 to 9 p.m., and we have programs and fun events every Thursday night. It's great. Bars open, people are around, and it's fun.
The Figge Museum's Executive Director, Tim Schiffer. Their African American Art Since 1950 exhibit continues through January 4th. The Turn Wood Show lasts until January 25th, and the 2014 College Invitational runs through February 8th. The Self-Taught Genius Treasures from the American Folk Art Museum opens on November 15th and lasts until March 15th. The Olson Larson Galleries in West Des Moines is offering a gallery talk on November 15th at 1 p.m. The Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society, along with the Drake Observatory in Des Moines, are hosting a Guitars Under the Stars tonight at 7:30. The Amara Piano Quartet is presenting a concert tomorrow night at 7:30 at ISU's Mary Ellen Tye Recital Hall. And the UI String Quartet Residency Program is presenting the Jasper Quartet in concert on November 14th at the Riverside Recital Hall. Just ahead, details about the Des Moines Metro Opera's Second Stages series in conjunction with Stage West Theater and the modern dance company called Co-Motion Dance Theater. This is the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
People frequently remark on our sense of humor, and I think they think dance is serious all the time, but really we're people like anybody else. So we actually, I have learned, are known for having a sense of humor. We have a good time. The dancers are spectacular movers, and one can always go watch dance just to see really skilled movers move. They are amazing. Their coordination, their flexibility, their strength is just amazing, but also the maturity of their performance is really, really lovely.
Dancer, choreographer, and teacher Valerie Williams has performed around the globe. In conjunction with being the director and a principal dancer with Co-Motion, Valerie has worked as rehearsal director for Bill T. Jones' Arnie Zane Dance Company, performs with Musica Antiqua, and serves as a choreographer for musical theater productions. Valerie started dancing as a toddler and hasn't stopped.
In our family, being an educated person was considered really good, and you were considered educated if you could discuss lots of different things like dance, music. So our parents made us do everything for at least 2 years. We had dance lessons for 2 years. We had to play a musical instrument. We had to be able to read music. We had to take a foreign language for 2 years. We had to study various things that the family considered necessary for being an educated person. Well, ballet, I have to say, was the most difficult thing that I did. And I continued in ballet because I liked it. It was so much more difficult than school, anything else that I did. I never expected to be a dancer, but what I discovered is that I am a dancer. I approach the world kinesthetically. I see the world really from what I now know as kind of a dancer's point of view. I see shapes. I experience sensually rather than verbally. And I just had to admit finally that I'm a dancer. And I thought, I'll just go for it. I'll try to make a living as a dancer. And if I can't, I'll make a living as something else. And I have been making a living in dance. In 1977, I met Sherry Satterstrom while I was performing with a musical theater company. And we were both interested in making modern dance. So Sherry and I formed Co-Motion Dance Theater, and we left our respective jobs to make this company and have kind of not looked back ever since.
Tell us a little bit about the mission of Co-Motion.
I truly believe in the individual's ability to express him or herself in movement, and I find modern dance the best way to do that. So Co-Motion Dance Theater started as a modern dance company, but also to help other people really experience that kind of self-expression in the discipline of dance. So we don't just move around. We do come from a technical base, and we use our training to make movement really palatable for an audience. But we use our minds and imaginations to experience the world and to show that different world experience that we all bring. So Commotion Dance Theater has done concert performances. We do performances in schools. And doing performances for smaller groups in libraries and taking dance to where people are, not just asking them to come to a really well-appointed stage and see us do our best in a theatrical atmosphere, but creating that atmosphere in a gymnasium, I think is really important. So Commotion Dance Theater does that too. Now lately, we have been doing a fair amount of work with interactive technology. Technology has kind of forced us to serve it. So I was interested in figuring out ways that dancers could be expressive with music, be expressive with settings on the stage, be expressive with projections, and interactive technologies have allowed me to do that. So working with composers and programmers and technology people, I've learned lots and lots about how to kind of bend things around so that the dancers can be expressive. In some of our performances, the music responds to the dancer's movement. And in fact, in my company, we say move or die. In other words, you move or there is no sound. You move or there is a different kind of sound. You move or there's no projection on the stage. And it allows the dancers to control what goes on the stage instead of the choreographer or the technical director controlling what goes on the stage.
I'd like to know more about your Women in Motion and Kids in Motion programs.
Kids Commotion and Women in Motion are two outreach programs of Commotion Dance Theaters. We have done residencies and assembly performances all over the place, and we formed Kids Commotion as a three-week performance workshop. The kids work dance an hour a day technique, and then we have composition, improvisation for an hour, and then we have a couple of hours of rehearsal after lunch. So the kids dance for about 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, and that culminates in a fully produced performance on a stage, costumes, lighting, everything, that melds my choreography and the students' choreography. So we start with a theme, and then we create dances based around that theme that go into making about an hour-long concert dance performance. Women in Motion is like Kids Commotion, but if we did that with people who are not used to moving all the time, we'd all be dead. So we wouldn't be able to move the next day. So Women in Motion rehearses on Sundays in February, March, and April along the same lines. We do technique, we do some composition, they learn dances that I teach them, they create dances, again, based around a theme, and then those dances are performed usually around Mother's Day weekend, fully produced, costumed, frequently original music.
Tell us about some of your residency topics.
Commotion Dance Theater, as artists in residence, teach classes in technique, because really, learning how to move your body well is the bottom line for what technique is. Applying style to technique gives us ballet, gives us jazz, gives us hip-hop, but really, learning how to use your body is, I think, the ultimate physical education. So we teach technique, but we also really let people move. So we set up situations for them to move, improvise, and then to create their own dances. So in residency situations, we can do all of that, including allowing people to share what they've done and not make it a performance, because that adds a level of, oh, I have to be perfect. Instead of just saying, I'm a human being in this social situation, it's okay for me to share what I've just done. So encouraging young people to do that, I hope, allows them to be freer as adults. So in residency situations, we can set dances, we can do general modern dance training, we can do specific style training like ballet, musical theater, but in general, we don't do those because so many communities have really good dance training available to them that I think it's better if we do things that are not available in their communities, like composition training, like improvisation training, like learning how to partner, how to give weight and share weight with someone, how to be a really supportive dancer. I mean that physically. We assume that they're going to be emotionally supporting.
Now on Monday, you're going to be heading to the Spencer area for a daytime assembly and then an evening concert. What will you be doing there?
We will be doing general repertory for the assembly performance that include shorter dances that are fun, that are a wide variety. So we have dances that are funny. We have dances that are serious. We try to present a really wide view of dance. So we have partnering. We have solos. And we talk about those dances as we do them and why we created the dances and a little bit about the music so that the students have an understanding not just of that particular dance, but also have an understanding of dance in general, we'll say. We make dance not scary. I'm always amazed at how many people think dance is scary, but it's not. It's part of our heritage. It's part of who we are as moving people. In the evening time, we've got a repertory concert planned that includes Flow, which is a series of dances that use interactive technologies and have original music by Walker Pett. We're also going to do a series of lullabies. These are lullabies from around the world, sung in their native languages. And that collection of dances is really sweet. It's funny. It's nice. It just makes you feel good. And we're going to do a dance called Catch Your Breath that, again, uses interactive technologies, but projection. So that dance has the dancers moving, and then their image catches up to them. It dissolves. It's really visually spectacular. And the dancers use the technology really beautifully.
Commotion's director, Valerie Williams. In addition to their Spencer performances, Commotion Dance Theater will present Bach Had 20 Children at the Ames City Auditorium on March 6th and 7th. For more details, please go to facebook.com/commotiondance. Just ahead, you'll discover what happens when you combine a play and an opera in one performance. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. The Des Moines Metro Opera and the Stage West Theater are joining forces with the Project of Primary Healthcare on a special collaborative performance of theater and music in support of World AIDS Day 2014. The double bill production will feature a play and an opera. Both works revolve around families intimately growing to understand the effects of the AIDS crisis. The Des Moines Metro Opera's artistic director, Michael Eagle.
We're very fortunate this coming December to be working on what is our third installment in our Second Stages series. And our Second Stages was launched last year as kind of an expansion of our successful summer festival season. We saw it as an opportunity to expand our community footprint, to collaborate with other arts organizations, to reach new audiences, to try out pieces that might not be necessarily appropriate for our main stage, and also as a real opportunity to demonstrate the power that art has to build bridges into our community, particularly centered around important issues. This collaboration, this time for our December Second Stages entry, is with Stage West Theater Company. And Stage West is a very successful theater company here in the Des Moines area, known for doing progressive and adventurous types of works. And we saw an opportunity to work together around a common issue. The production is centered around World AIDS Day 2014, and to present a performance where the first act is a play, take the intermission, and then the second act will be a small opera, a chamber opera. So Stage West will be presenting a play called The Baltimore Waltz by Paula Vogel, and Des Moines Metro Opera will present Jake Heggie's The Three Decembers.
And you also are collaborating with another organization as well with this.
Right, the Project of Central Iowa, which devotes resources and efforts to individuals struggling with the HIV/AIDS epidemic. A portion of the proceeds from the event will be given to the project.
And coming up this month in November, you're going to be doing a special art exhibit again. This is very exciting.
That's right. The Grandview art students at the Grandview University, they will be hosting an event on November 15th where students of the university have created works of art in a variety of media centered around a line from Three Decembers. Charlie, one of the lead characters in Three Decembers, says, "Everyone has a name." It's part of an aria that he sings, and relating to the fact that this massive epidemic may be global and widespread in its reach, but that every single person has a story, every person has a name, and that we need to spend the time thinking about and remembering that this pandemic is comprised of millions and millions of individuals, and they all have names.
And then also on December 4th, you're going to be doing another event as well.
Yes, it's a poetry event that will be held at the Des Moines Social Club.
This is a marvelous collaboration, and you're bringing together The Baltimore Waltz and Three Decembers. Tell us just briefly a bit about each one.
Well, I'll talk to you about Three Decembers because that's the piece that we're presenting and that I feel like I'm the expert to speak about there. One of the things I love about Jake Heggie and the works that he writes for the stage is that it kind of harkens me back to a line that I heard very early on in my operatic career, which is, the opera house is the place where you go to have your life sung back at you and maybe even amplified a little bit. And I think that Jake does that by featuring works and stories that tell the stories of our own time and our own land. This opera came right on the heels of Dead Man Walking, which of course was performed in 2000. And it's based on a short play by Terrence McNally, who is a famous American playwright, also the playwright for Dead Man Walking, based on his play called Some Christmas Letters that he had written for a performance at Carnegie Hall for an actual AIDS benefit in around December of 1999. And McNally shared this play with Jake Heggie, and he said immediately upon, he sat down and just devoured it. It's very short, maybe 14, 15 pages long, and he devoured it immediately. And as he was reading it, he could begin to hear the music unfolding in his mind about how it would be set to music. And one of the great champions of Jake Heggie's work has always been the great mezzo-soprano Friederike von Stade. And both Jake and Flicka, as she's called, began to see opportunity for a wonderful role to be created for her in the central character. The play itself is about identity. It's about family, the families that we're born into, the families, that, you know, the ones that we create, the truth about who we are, who our family is, and who our parents are. And that is, you know, the central theme, I think, of this story. It contains three characters, that's it, a very small number of forces. It centers around Madeline Mitchell, who is a famous Broadway actress. You might want to think somebody like Meryl Streep or one of the great Broadway divas of the day, and her two adult children, each of whom is coming to terms with who they are and situations in their family, coming to terms, I think, with forgiving an absentee mother, in a sense. And it's a beautiful, beautiful tale. The music, I think, is very appealing. It's written for a small chamber ensemble of 10 instrumentalists. And in listening to it and getting to learn it, it really reminds me of a great Broadway musical on a shorter time frame.
And you are bringing in some terrific performers. Tell us about the three musicians.
Well, we're very excited about the cast. The show opens early December, and we have a very short rehearsal period. It's, of course, a short piece, so we don't necessarily need all the time that we normally have. And we felt it was very important for us to bring in people who knew the roles that they're about to sing, who have done them many times. And so the three people that we have coming in to sing this performance for us are very well-versed in the show and are wonderful artists and singers in their own right. Keith Ferris, who is a baritone, I've been wanting to bring to Des Moines Metro Opera for many, many years, is singing the role of Charlie. Keith created that role in the first performance at the Houston Grand Opera in 2008, was the year that it premiered, and he's gone on to sing this role numerous times all over the United States. The central role of Madeline Mitchell, the mother, will be sung by Janice Hall, who has a very long and storied career as an actress, as a Broadway performer, and as a singer, and I've heard wonderful things about her portrayal of Madeline in this particular piece, so I'm very excited for her to be part of the cast. And then rounding out the cast is Emily Pulley, who's playing Beatrice, the daughter, the third character of the show, and she herself has done the opera many times, so we're excited to have them here with us in December.
And tell us, maybe just list a couple of the pieces that are arias people might hear in this work.
My favorite part of the show is, I think, the ending. It's called Three Decembers because the action takes place over three consecutive Decembers, where the mother, Madeline, will write or call or send a Christmas letter to each of the kids, updating them essentially on what is happening in her career. That's the length of the holiday spirit that they get, is an update on, you know, what role she's doing and that sort of thing. It's sort of comical and sort of tragic all at the same time. But each of the scenes takes place in one of these three Decembers. The first one in 1986, the second one in 1996, and the last one in 2006. And the final scene is a little bit of a reflection from the two children, actually after Madeline has passed away, after her funeral, where they're beginning to come to terms with their memory and to sort of let go of some of their struggles with her. And she comes forward kind of as a ghost and sort of an epilogue at the end. And they sing a trio called Isn't Life Grand? And I think the words are quite moving and sum the story up quite well. And she says, "Isn't life grand? I'm awfully glad I showed up for it." And the children say, "So are we, Mother." And, you know, I think we'll all be okay in the end. And it's a beautiful, beautiful story. Anytime that I've seen the piece, you can hear people sniffling in the audience because they're so touched by it. And it kind of ends, actually rather appropriately, with holiday wishes, which I think it's not necessarily a holiday piece, but it's nice to have that tie-in at this time of the year, that it has that Merry Christmas theme at the end from the characters. I'm very much looking forward to it, and I think listeners will enjoy this piece very much.
How can folks get more information and get tickets?
Tickets are always available at our website, DesMoinesMetroOpera.org. You're also able to call our main office, which is 515-961-6221, and Dennis Hendrickson will be happy to help you out. And also for this particular performance, tickets are available at Ticketmaster as well.
And this is going to be held at the Temple for the Performing Arts in downtown Des Moines, which is a very intimate space, so you don't want to wait too long to get your tickets.
There's a very limited number of seats due to the nature of the size of the theater. So if your listeners haven't got their tickets already, they'll want to do that right away. We anticipate that it will sell out, certainly. And I'm looking forward to seeing the play, The Baltimore Waltz, presented by Stage West. That is a bit more satirical look, I think. If ours is a tender and an emotional look at the effects of the HIV-AIDS crisis, this is, I think, maybe a little bit more tongue-in-cheek, a little more satirical kind of play. And I'm looking forward to learning it and discovering it as part of the same evening along with our audience members.
The Des Moines Metro Opera's artistic director, Michael Eagle. Today's Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks goes to Kathy Eldon, Doris Mangin, Danica Holmes, Tony Daner, Tim Schiffer, Valerie Williams, and Michael Eagle. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner. Thanks for this show also goes to IPR's Jason Burns, Garrett Van Leeuwen, and music director Al Scherz. Program research was provided by Nick Carlo and Scott Bosco. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. Have a happy and safe Thanksgiving. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.